Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. The novelist Richard Powers is the kind of writer who sees the interlocking details of almost everything. He writes at times from this view on high, literally talking to readers from the tallest redwood and from as deep a place and as microscopic as the inside of a leaf spore or wherever human curiosity and misery and desire live inside of us. Powers began writing his very first novel while living in Boston. His new book, The Overstory, is his 12th, and trees and people take turns as the story's protagonists. He weaves together 9 human characters, among them Nicholas Hoel, whose Norwegian ancestors plant a chestnut tree that grows strong far from its native soil out on an Iowan farm. There's Mimi Ma, whose immigrant Chinese father invests too much heart in a mulberry tree, and Neely Mehta, a young coding prodigy growing up in California who, as an adolescent, he looks for solace climbing up an ancient Spanish oak. The novel has a complex structure.
The book itself is structured as an enormous tree that you begin the book reading these 8 seemingly independent short stories that have nothing in common except this sense that each has been troubled by a tree. Each of these characters has been forced to re-examine who they are or where they come from because of some anxious relationship to things that aren't human, in particular a particular species.
And you
tree.
Call them in the structure of the book, you call them the roots.
That's right.
On purpose.
The first portion of the book is roots. We have these separate characters who are separated and independent and, in a way, underground. It's the backstory of the main thrust of the novel. And in the second part of the book, they grow together into a trunk. And this story, 5 of the 9 characters do actually meet up in time and space and join forces in an attempt in the 1990s in the Pacific Northwest to save the last 3 to 5% of old growth uncut forests. The first character that we meet in this extremely condensed family saga that unfolds like a fast action movie in its own right is Jürgen Hoel, who comes over just before the Civil War, works briefly in the shipyards of Brooklyn, falls in love and marries an Irish immigrant, and brings her out to Homestead in Iowa, and also brings, by accident, a handful of chestnuts in his coat pocket, which they plant, and as they begin to raise this increasingly sprawling family, he does plant this unexpected legacy, and one of the trees survives.
So all of these characters, they develop over the course of their lives. They struggle. Each of them has an incredible loss, not just the death of a someone in their family, but a tragic death. Mm. And that tragic death sends them off into the next part of their life in some way. It always does, inevitably, for any of us.
Right.
You know, in a way, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and it lands and it stays there and no one's cleaning it up,
right.
It's fodder. It's becoming, you know, nutrient. It's becoming, you know, a place to hide for some animal life. What is this you're trying to do here with these tragic deaths that happen? And I don't want to give anything away. And linking it, again, the interweaving into a natural life, a science life, a life
right.
of biology.
Right. If it isn't a literal death, it's some kind of catastrophe that transfers the character from a safe place into an uncertain one. And it's that almost mythic journey into the underworld that they all have to come back out from. You know, we live with the illusion of safety. And that safety makes us blind to everything else. It makes us think that meaning is a purely personal thing and that all we need to do is take care and prosper and somehow figure out how to get out of this place alive, and we're not going to do it. And the realization that we're not going to do it, I think, is the kind of bond of blood that unites these characters in a common cause in the second part of the book.
So your book is bound to be embraced by those activists who are and did try to save was the spotted owl versus the families who were supported by the timber industry, right? So this is a story that's going to play out at other times in real life, not only in your narrative. Your book is going to be called maybe by some a novel, an environmentalist's novel is. How do you feel about that?
I'm okay with that. You know, when you think about the variety of ways of telling a story, what makes a good conflict, what makes a good dramatic showdown, it seems to me that there are actually three kinds of crisis or confrontation that we can write about. We can write about an individual person whose values are conflicted, a person who wants one thing but finds that in the wanting they have to pay a price that they may or may not be comfortable for. We can call that a psychological novel. Then there's a second order of conflict, which is one person's values are at odd with another person's values, or one group of people hold something dear that another group does not. And that would be a social novel or a political novel. Literary fiction is very, very good at both of those, and we've become super adept at both reading and writing those kinds of stories. The third kind of conflict, which actually infuses all of literature for most of its history, but has dropped out of the story in recent times, perhaps for as long as a century, is this notion of the conflict between human beings and the not human. How do we accommodate and come to terms with an entire world that wants other things than we do? That's a different kind of drama. If you call the first political or psychological, the second political or social, I'm comfortable calling the third environmental, although the term comes with baggage.
Right, right. Which is what happens with anything that you put out in the world. Somebody's going to grab it and make it. You know, they're going to take their baggage and connect
it. That's right. Right. There is no term.
But this is a particular. You've taken a chance because you write from a place of literature. Your other work has been it's been about music, and it's been about the digital life, and it's been about many different things, and much of that is also in the story.
There are psychological components and social components.
Yes, yep. and change, inevitable change, and there was one beautiful part where I think Bernile Mehta says, or you write maybe, and he's a youngster at this point. His parents still refer to California as the Golden State.
Right.
And it's just before it becomes, the word Silicon comes up. And you know we're talking about Silicon Valley, where so much has developed. And we have characters in here who were, another character. Her father developed the precursor or the cell phone, right?
That's right.
This family, the Mehta family, is in the virtual world. So we're not just in the trees here, and we're certainly not out in Iowa or in Oregon only. We are living a very modern life in this book in the 90s.
That's right.
A little before all the social media that's cropped up. It's just beginning.
That's right.
God, that would have changed the whole storyline, right, if there was Twitter
and right. Well,
and Facebook
it emerges as an important component right at the end of the book.
Right, right, right.
But you're describing exactly the trajectory that makes this a book about human beings looking for home and somehow getting onto this trajectory where they think they've defeated the world, they think that they've mastered and had dominion and subdued the earth, and they're migrating out into these other places, into these virtual, digital, proxy places, and are now being called back, are now hearing the world resist the human attempt to turn it into a different place. Interestingly, I should interject a couple of things. One, that Nile's Silicon Valley, you learn in the course of this book, was previously the Valley of Heart's Delight. Mm. There was nothing in the Central Peninsula in that area, which is now Google HQ, Apple HQ, Intel, Facebook, you name it, used to be fruit orchards. It used to be trees as far as the eye can see.
I want to also ask you to, would you read this passage that's really a conversation with a tree?
In this passage, the artist Nicholas Houl is lying in a sleeping bag in the morning in the boreal north prior to going back to work on a large-scale land art project that becomes the final image of the book. And he's looking up at a stand of spruces that are blowing in the breeze, and he suddenly has this sense of the tips of these trees being enormous writing implements that are somehow tracing out words against the sky. But the spruces pour out messages in media of their own invention. They speak through their needles, trunks, and roots. They record in their own bodies the history of every crisis they've lived through. The man in the tent lies bathed in signals hundreds of millions of years older than his crude senses. And still, he can read them. The five white spruces sign the blue air. They write, light and water and a little crushed stone demand long answers. Nearby lodgepoles and jack pines demur. Long answers need long time, and long time is exactly what's vanishing. The black spruces down the drumlin put it bluntly. Warm is feeding on warm. The permafrost is belching. The cycle speeds up. Farther south, broadleaves agree. Noisy aspens and remnant birches. Forests of cottonwood and poplars take up the chorus. The world is turning into a new thing. The man rolls over onto his back, face to face with the morning sky. The messages swarm him. Even here, homeless, he thinks, nothing will be the same. The spruces answer, nothing has ever been the same. We're all doomed, the man thinks. We have always been doomed. But things are different this time. Yes, you are here.
That's Richard Powers reading from his new novel, The Overstory. You know, I don't know that everybody walks around saying we are desperate for answers. I walk around saying we are desperate for answers.
I think many, many people do, but I don't think they articulate it either out loud to themselves or to their friends. I really believe that the great majority of us are suffering from what psychologists call species loneliness, not loneliness for other human beings. We're lonely because we've talked ourselves into believing we're the only game in town. We're the only interesting thing going on. And that's why we're, you know, that's why we look at Facebook 158 times a day. But it feed that hunger for something that's not us can't be fed by us. And it turns into this saltwater addiction where we're getting thirstier the more we drink.
Right. But are you in your writing this kind of pointing to the human species as, okay, folks, you're taking this down. While yourself included,
yes,
are living on this planet, and we're reading books and we're publishing books and we're sitting at a wood table, by the way, and there's wood floor,
yes,
under our feet, and the building's got
framed
lots of wood.
Out,
and
yep.
I looked at every tree driving in here this morning in my car, you know, with a fossil fuel and all that. We are the source of the destruction as well as the source of living on this planet and loving it and taking care of it and being a species that evolves.
Beautifully so, put. It's a book that's saying, look, this solution, you know, this thing that trees do, getting up on a woody trunk and sticking out your solar cells and turning the sun into food and into everything there is, it's been around for a long time. It has gone through, it was invented many times independently by natural selection. It has gone through mass extinctions, right? It's a pretty good thing to put your money on. The question is whether we're going to come through on the other end. And that the answer to that question depends on tapping into our own magnificence, our own ability to see and think and project and model and understand, to tell stories and to hear stories.
As a writer, you've been doing this in other books where you sort of erase the chasm between music and technology, or a Bach cantata, as a friend of mine wrote to me about some of the work she's read of yours, and an airplane and a bird and a brain injury. She is a philosophy professor, once a radio producer, by the way, and she writes that at the end of reading your other books that she feels both a sublime sense of elation and terror, and that, you know, maybe she's just, by reading something that you've written where you've woven all these things together, shown us a little bit, or maybe the entirety of the meaning of life. That's her take. And it is breathtaking to travel so fast in these people's lives in the story, and in the lives of these forests too. They're much older than all of us.
I deeply appreciate what your friend says. And in fact, it was echoed by an early reviewer of the book who said something like, I've never read a book so relentlessly bleak and yet so endlessly hopeful. What I'm trying to do in this book and in the previous books is to move meaning outside, to get rid of this idea that it's something that we have to create for ourselves privately, and to say, no, look, it's out there. It's going crazy. It's connected in a million ways, and you're there. You're in it. You just have to stand still and see.
Richard Powers, I want to thank you so much for coming in and giving us just a glimpse into all of this in The Overstory.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
That is novelist Richard Powers, the winner of the National Book Award and a MacArthur Fellow, and his new book is called The Overstory. And that is our show for today and this week, produced by a mob of great colleagues. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jill Kaufman. Have a great weekend.